Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support for WGTD also comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. The following Morning Show program was recorded yesterday, and the program can also be viewed, if you prefer, from WGTD's Facebook page, where you can experience it both in audio and video as well. My thanks to Troy McDonald and his skilled crew for his assistance in making this Morning Show program possible.
And we welcome you to the Morning Show here on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and I am really excited to be doing the Morning Show today from a beautiful business on the south side of Kenosha, a business which had its soft opening back on Valentine's Day and its official grand opening on the 10th of April. Namely, a business called Classic Violins. And this is a business that sells violins, rents violins, and also repairs violins. And not just violins, but every instrument in the string family. And even though both Kenosha and Racine have fine general-purpose music stores, there was not a store in the Kenosha-Racine area that specialized in string instruments and some of the unique, distinctive issues that are part of the string instrument family. So this is a welcome addition to the musical landscape here in southeastern Wisconsin. And I'm very happy to be here with Stephanie Shumanova. And her father is actually the owner of Classic Violins. Their original location is down in Mundelein, Illinois. And now there is the second location right here in Kenosha. And we're going to be spending today's morning show not only exploring classic violins, but also talking about what they do here and about some of the special challenges that are part of selecting a string instrument and keeping it in perfect repair and restoring a string instrument when something has happened to it. And in just a few minutes, we're going to be moving into sort of the workshop area of classic violins, and we'll be meeting a luthier who does actual restoration work and repair work on violins. But in the meantime, Stephanie Shumanova, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you very much, Greg. I'm very happy to be here with you today.
Well, it's great to finally be in the door of Classic Violins after having heard so much about it, and it's a beautiful place you have here. And I couldn't help but notice that right out front is kind of a distinctive-looking vehicle that I have a feeling is kind of a trademark. Tell our listeners what I'm talking about.
Well, this is our van, which we named the Strati Wagon. We had a poll on our Facebook page, and we invited our customers to name our new van. This is the van that we do weekly service to the schools whose orchestra programs we service. And the name that won was Strati Wagon, so from Stradivarius and Wagon, so a Strati Wagon, and this Strati Wagon visits different schools throughout the week.
Well, I'm sure young people get a real kick out of that, and I'm sure somewhere Stradivarius himself is sort of in wonderment that such a thing is possible. That's terrific. I would love to know a little bit about your background and that of your father, who of course is the owner of Classic Violins. Did he grow up as a violinist or a virtuoso in one of the other members of the string family?
He's actually a maker, and there is a difference between makers and players, but he makes string instruments, violins, violas, and cellos, and so do the rest of the members of our luthier family. We are originally from Bulgaria, a small Eastern European country on the Balkan Peninsula. And my father, the founder of Classic Violins, has always been an entrepreneur. As you know, Bulgaria used to be a socialist country, and as such, it provided great social benefits to its residents, but very minimal opportunities to people with entrepreneurial spirit like my father. Mm. So he did find opportunities, great opportunities in the United States when he first traveled in 1989 was the year when he first came to the United States, set up an agency here doing wholesale of violins in white, which are unfinished instruments. Ah. He visited different violin shops in California and traveled through the United States offering violins in white and also handmade accessories for string instruments that were very high quality made in Bulgaria.
So when you build a white violin, then typically who finishes it then? Are there specialists who do just that?
Yeah, there are actually many shops look for violins in white, so these handmade instruments that they just want to varnish and set up. So in this way, there is one maker that makes the violin in white, and then there is a different maker here in the United States who is going to apply the varnish and do the setup.
So, for instance, the instruments that you sell here, are they all made by your father or someone on your staff?
No, actually, they're not. My father still has a workshop in Bulgaria, and there are a number of luthiers who we work with in Bulgaria that make instruments for us with our specifications, and they're especially made for classic violins. And we do work with luthiers from all around the world. So we work with luthiers from Romania, China, the Czech Republic, Italy, and we buy instruments from these luthiers that we sell in our shop.
Very good. So the term luthier, such as Spencer, who we're going to meet in just a moment, does that term imply that this is someone who actually creates these instruments necessarily, or can a luthier specialize in some other facet of this?
Well, that's true, yes. A luthier is a person who makes string instruments and also repairs and restores string instruments. So you will see in the repair shop that we have blocks of wood, maple and spruce from which the instruments are made, and these are the initial stages of making an instrument. So a luthier is somebody who is going to cut that instrument from these blocks of wood and craft a string instrument.
So typically someone who knows how to build a violin or cello also knows, in a sense, how to restore or repair them.
Exactly, yes. That's correct. So.
I don't remember if you said if your father actually played an instrument or his love of string instruments is simply as a luthier.
His love of string instruments is simply as a luthier. All of the luthiers can play the instruments a little bit so that they can try them, but they're not professional musicians. So that's why when they complete the making of an instrument, we have professional musicians that try the instruments and they do sound post adjustments and other adjustments to make the instrument sound at its best.
Fantastic. Tell us a little bit about your own pathway to being part of classic violins. I mean, I'm sure to some extent it was nearly inevitable that that this would be part of your life, or certainly could be if you were interested, but do you come at this as a musician?
I'm not a musician and I'm not a maker. I'm the only one from the family who is not a maker, but I do this, what I'm doing right now. So I do advertising for the company. I also am responsible for recruitment of new accounts, establishing relationship with new schools, music teachers, private studios, creating advertising materials and looking for new customers. By profession, I'm a linguist, and I used to teach at Northeastern Illinois University, and I also used to teach English as a second language.
Ah, well, you use English beautifully, better than I do, so this is terrific. The profession of luthier, how rare is that? And generally speaking, how do people find their way into that profession and become skilled at that line of work?
It is still a very rare profession, and when my father first came to the United States and he visited many shops, He was told that one of the best schools for that profession is actually located in Chicago. The other one is in Cremona, Italy. And still in this profession, things are made by hand. Machines are not used or are used minimally. And his only thought when he was traveling through these shops is how to unite the family that already had some interest in violin making, since he owned a workshop in Bulgaria, how to unite the family in that business and have everybody work in that business here in the United States. He learned from the shops that he visited that it is a very rare profession and there is a demand of luthiers here in the United States. So that's actually how we came to the United States as future students to study the mastery of making string instruments. And it is, as I said, still a very rare profession.
Mm. We have, of course, around us some beautiful examples of what you sell and rent here at Classic Violins. Mm-hmm. And I think most of our listeners are aware that we're talking about violins and violas and cellos mm-hmm. and double basses. What might be not be apparent to the typical listener is that even within those basic instruments, we have different sizes. Although I think a small violin and a full-size violin are still a violin, so
yes.
it's not quite the same as different kinds of saxophones, for instance. Mm-hmm. How many different sizes of violin, for instance, does typically one find at a place like Classic Violins?
Well, we offer the smallest violin, and it's 132. And that's for a three-year-old child.
Mm.
And
so the one hanging there at the very end.
The first one. So that's a 132. And then it goes all the way to a full-size instrument before the viola begin. And after 132, we have 116, 110, 1/8, a quarter size, half size, three-quarter, and a full-size violin. So as the child grows, they switch to different sizes, and we usually joke that this small instrument that's for a three-year-old is for children that have parents with great ambitions. A small instrument for children with parents with great ambitions.
Yeah. And the other instruments of the string family also have these variations in size, I assume?
Yes, the same is with the violas and the cellos. In fact, there is one cello that you're going to see in the trial room that's a 1/10 cello. Hmm. And it's a cello that a kindergartner will play.
Very good. Mm-hmm. And you make double basses also, or do you go as large as cellos?
We actually sell and rent basses, but we don't make basses. Our luthiers specialize in the making of violins, violas, and cellos.
Very good. Double bass is the closest I ever came to playing a string instrument. When I was in junior high, the orchestra director came to me and said I should learn to play the double bass, but I didn't want to get up early in the morning for rehearsal, so I turned him down. I have had regrets ever since because I just think it would be so interesting to know how to play one of these instruments.
They're very popular instruments nowadays. They were in great demand last year. Usually the demand goes through waves. For example, we had one year when all the students wanted to play violas, and then the next year all of them shifted to basses. So it was in great demand last year, for example.
I suppose maybe when someone sees Yo-Yo Ma play on television, suddenly the cello will be
exactly.
a hot item.
It's very inspiring.
I know that one of the reasons we are having this morning show conversation when we are is because of where this date falls in the school year, in terms of certain students probably beginning to make certain choices about perhaps playing a string instrument and maybe choosing a particular instrument to play. Tell us more about that.
Well, the Kenosha Unified School District has this unique summer program. Unlike any other school district, they actually have their recruitment meetings at the end of the school year in May. And then they begin a summer program at the middle of June. And in this way, they prepare the students for the school year that will begin in September. So we'll be having a number of students who will be calling us, hopefully, from the Kenosha Unified School District around the end of May to rent instruments. And we'll be delivering instruments for the new orchestra students the second week of June.
Fantastic. For those of you just joining us on the morning show, I am at Classic Violins on the south side of Kenosha, and speaking right now with Stephanie Shumanova. Her father is the owner of Classic Violins, and Stephanie is very much the heart and soul of this business, its major spokesperson, and does a lot of the outreach for Classic Violins. And we're going to be moving now to a different room in Classic Violins, namely the domain of a luthier by the name of Spencer Hammond, who appears to be hard at work. Spencer, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. Pleasure. It's a pleasure.
It's great to be here after hearing so much about this this fascinating and beautiful place. So tell us a little more about what a luthier like yourself is equipped to do.
Sure. Well, luthiers have different specialties, and some perform different operations depending upon where they're working or what the call is. As you were discussing with Stephanie before, luthiers can do anything from making new instruments. It can be repairing and maintaining and adjusting existing instruments, or it can be restorations of antique instruments, which have maybe sat idle for decades and are now coming surfacing again and being set up for a new generation to enjoy.
After sitting in someone's closet maybe for a while.
We get a lot of those.
What is your particular specialty?
My specialty is primarily repairs and restorations. I'm doing a lot of artistic restorations and cosmetic things, making an instrument that's had a very hard life look shiny and new again in a lot of ways, but respectfully so. It's very much an art form. Doing so respectfully, not just slapping new varnish on something, but meticulously touching up damage and erasing years of wear and use.
Very good. And I suppose we're talking about two different things. We're talking about making the violin look as beautiful as possible, but more important, having it sound as beautiful as possible.
Absolutely. There are two very different disciplines. And just as we use the expression, sometimes you eat with your eyes first, people will tend to look at an instrument first and get an impression before even hearing it of, for better or worse, what they might expect. And just as producing a beautiful sound, you want to be seen with this thing as well. So it's two sides of the same coin.
Good point. Before we talk about repair and restoration, I actually want to hear a little bit about the matter of maintenance or maintaining a violin. So I suppose that's ideally what people do, is perhaps bring their violins or whatever string instrument we're talking about on a regular basis for this kind of maintenance. I suppose the same way somebody might do that or not do that with their automobile. What kinds of things typically are part of maintaining the quality of an instrument?
Sure, you are absolutely right on with the automobile analogy. This is one we use a lot. It can be difficult talking to somebody maybe uninitiated about violin parts, but when you convert it into terms of something that they are comfortable with, automobiles, for example, it is a good analog. So there are things that we will do or should be done yearly or multiple times a year, including things like lubricating the pegs of the instrument so it will stay in tune and be easy to tune and usable for the player. Naturally, there are things like changing out strings as well. Strings have a shelf life, never mind that they might break, but after a while they will lose some of their tone quality and need to be replaced. Sometimes if instruments change and we need to do things like making new bridges or new sound posts or other aspects of the physical instrument, these set of parts, sometimes it's gluing cracks or damage that can happen over the course of life, or just the wonderful Midwest humidity changes. Having four distinct seasons gives us a lot of work to do, because things need to be as humidity and weather and temperature changes up and down. So does the instrument, and then we need to keep on top of that as well. So it's We try and make that point across, too, that it's very much like buying a car. You don't drive it off the lot, and that's the end. You will be continuously working on this and maintaining this, and there was some input from you as well.
Right. So I suppose we're talking about, in a sense, some fluidity between maintenance and restoration and repair, that someone comes in with their violin thinking everything's fine, and you probably, upon close examination, can point out that, in fact, we have an issue here, and if we don't take care of it now, it'll become more serious.
Absolutely. Education is a huge part of what we wind up doing with going through the various things that need to be done on an instrument, and sometimes it is difficult to articulate, or sometimes it can be painful to articulate, because things look, okay, it has four strings. Well, what more do you want? Well, unfortunately, quite several things.
Well, I think we need to take a closer look at this beautiful room and some of what you have here to do the work that you do.
Absolutely.
And I'm especially struck by this cabinet in the corner. It reminds me of that wonderful scene from Toy Story 2 when some intricate repairs being done on the Woody doll, and it looks like just a cabinet full of wonders. Is this a working cabinet, or is this more for show?
Yes, this is my toolbox, and I keep most of my tools in there. All of these drawers are full of various items, various tools that I use in the process. It's fully functional, not just for show. Of course, it's nice to look nice, too.
I've
done some work with the cosmetics on it, of course. But, yeah, everything is functional. Collecting and maintaining of tools is very much a part of this job as well, and people take a lot of pride generally in the tools that they own and maintaining them. I have a collection of antique and modern tools that I like to keep using, some tools as recent as a few years old, some which are over 100.
Wow.
So
I'm noticing also some of the pieces here on your desk. Could you talk us through some of what is there?
Sure. A few things that are on the desk, just in particular. We have some very small files that we use for doing adjustments of nut slots and bridge slots, the places where the strings go over. This in particular is a calipers for measuring very fine tolerances in tenths of millimeters.
Wow.
Millimeters become literally miles in this profession. I have some various finishes and things. This is a jar of shellac that we use on touching up instruments and helping to restore varnish. Various brushes and pencils. The tool in the back, the thing that looks kind of like a cricket bat, is what's called a strop, a paddle strop, which is used for helping to hone and maintain the fine edges of the tools that we're using daily.
Wow. And I noticed that behind you, Spencer, was what I thought at a glance was your lunch, but I'm pretty sure it's not. It's something else. Tell us why this hot plate is here.
So this is the glue, believe it or not, that we use for putting these instruments together. The glue that we use on violins and violas and cellos and basses is what's called hide glue. It's a very specific type of glue that works in a very specific way to help hold instruments together. It's not something you necessarily just run out and buy to the store. It's not the same as your average carpenter wood glue. You know, it has to work in a specific way with the instrument. It comes as a granulated powder, which looks kind of like sugar. This sugar, essentially, we dissolve in water, which makes kind of an amber-looking liquid. You can see this is solid.
Mm-hmm.
But this glue will be put in a water bath, and the hot plate will be turned on, which heats it up and melts it and brings it to a liquid state, which we can then use on putting the instruments together. As it dries, it cools and mechanically bonds things.
Amazing. What about the small little drawers that are on the desk right over here?
These are full of, right now, just a number of odds and ends, small pieces of wood that we've saved from things or we'll use for patches or different repair works. Have some pieces of old pegs in here, which we'll sometimes use for ebony or little pieces if we need to restore something or put something back that wasn't there.
Mm. I noticed the violin that's on the desk has braces on it, so is that a fingerboard that is being reattached?
Yes, this is a customer's instrument that we're in the process of right now. The fingerboard had begun coming unglued, which is just something that can happen over time. One of the things with hide glue is that it's designed to be able to give way if there is too much internal tension on the wood, and so this instrument had been sitting for a very long time, and the fingerboard began separating, so had to re-glue it, clean up the surfaces first, I should say, then re-glue this, and here it is clamped, and about ready to move on to the next step.
I should think that the process of clamping is especially delicate, that if one was careless or a little too quick, you could really do some damage to a precious violin.
Definitely. Considering how thin the materials are in general, behind you, I can give a good illustration. Ribs for instruments, for example, the side parts of the instruments are very, very thin. This is the thickness of an instrument rib,
wow.
And you can see it's only a few millimeters. So if you put too much pressure on something like that when you're gluing it, you can crush it. The violin doesn't have the same kind of internal braces as, say, a guitar does.
Hmm.
And so some of this fineness means that it will be more susceptible to changes in weather, but the flip side of that being that same fineness allows it to perform and vibrate and have a greater tonal range.
What is on this desk here, does this represent, in a sense, a violin in the process of being built?
Correct. So these are a number of different pieces and some instruments that I put out here to display that are things in progress and showing you everything from starting, for example, a top of an instrument, which starts out as a couple pieces of wood, just raw wood, spruce in this case, which will be cleaned up, plain, joined together. You can see the instrument outline, the back of an instrument on that piece of maple there. The what is called a mold, which we use for making the ribs. You can see the ribs sitting on the table there as well. These will be joined around this to make that shape of the instrument. Various other parts we have as well. We have the inlay, the purfling inlay in the raw form that goes around the outside of the instrument for decoration and for strength. You can see there are three blocks in a row that show an instrument neck, one just in the very raw state as just a block of wood, second in progress having been cut, freed from the wood using a template to trace that out, and then one a little further along with that scroll being carved and starting to look a little bit more like a violin scroll.
Very good.
Some fingerboards.
Wonderful. And then I'm guessing that hanging above the desk here, in addition to the other string instruments that a lot of people recognize, is what I imagine gets used for the all-important bow. You can't have much of a string instrument if you don't have a bow.
Absolutely. We view, and you kind of have to view, the bow is half of your musical equipment. It is absolutely vital to producing the sound on a violin family instrument. Keeping a bow rehaired and in good working order is very important as well. Keeping a bow rehaired or having to change that hair out at least once a year, sometimes more than that, depending upon how aggressive the player may be or if they touch the bow hair. It is natural harvested horse hair. So just like with your own hair, if you ran your fingers through your hair every day and never washed it, it would get pretty disgusting, and that's what can happen to bow hair over time,
right.
So it's necessary to replace that.
Now, I don't remember seeing bows that have such dark horse hair. Is that commonly used?
Sometimes on base bows. The darker hair, there are different types of hair that are more or less, I guess, aggressive. They grip the string a little bit more. The surface of bow hair microscopically is almost like Velcro, and so that kind of, these little teeth will, on the microscopic level, help grab that string, make it resonate and vibrate and give you the sound. So sometimes bass players, for example, with very big, wide, large diameter strings that are quite long, will like a hair that's a little more grippy so they can make that string vibrate easier and produce more sound.
Right, right. Yeah, and I imagine a lot depends on what kind of music you're going to be playing. I think of video I've seen of the Kronos Quartet.
Yes.
And when they are playing vigorously and aggressively, you see the horsehair kind of flying in every direction. And I should imagine if you're going to be playing that versus playing Brahms, you might make some different choices.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I was struck that on your website, where you list the various kinds of repairs that you are equipped to do here at Classic Violins, that for the bow alone, there was, I think, a list of maybe 10 different basic repairs that you could do for a bow, and that was really interesting to me. That list was as long as the list of the kind of repairs you do for the violin itself.
Yes, indeed.
So probably a lot of people need to realize that the bow itself is much more complex and more significant than probably most people appreciate.
Absolutely. This is a big thing we emphasize in the maintenance department and also when people are choosing instruments. We're helping people select things and budgeting. You know, sometimes people may have the outlook on it to say, well, I've got a certain amount of money, I'll put most of that money into buying the best violin I can and have a little bit left over for a bow. Well, it's got to be a match. There's got to be some correlation there. As I mentioned before, if you think of it as each being half of the complete musical setup, it makes no sense to have one that is exceptional and one that is horrible. There's got to be some balance there. And a bow that is not set up to work correctly or has worn hair or any of these other problems will never make even the nicest violin sound as good as it could.
Good point. For those of you just joining us, we are spending this morning's show at Classic Violins on the south side of Kenosha. And Spencer Hammon is with me right now. He is the on-site luthier at Classic Violins. Are you the one and only luthier at this site?
Not the one and only. I'm here most of the time, but two of the other family members, Petio and Plamen, are also here occasionally as well. But usually if you come in, you'll run into me, at least on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. So.
Very good. And I wonder, how long can you intently work on an instrument or given instruments? I should think that this is very intense work. And Is it difficult to do it, for instance, all day long?
Well, there is a lot of concentration involved. Routinely, it will be lots of things go in steps. So it works very well in a lot of cases. You can do a step and then maybe stand up for a second, stretch, take a breather, regroup yourself for the next part, and then continue on. So 8 hours a day of work is not uncommon, but there's a lot of focus, just like any skilled trade, I suppose.
Yeah. And did you come to this as a violinist originally?
I originally came to music as a fourth grader, learning viola in the public schools up in Sheboygan. Had some really good teachers and had a wonderful experience with that. And I came to instrument making and restoration early in high school. My private lessons teacher, the late Mark Cooley, was the luthier in Sheboygan. And he had some interest in me, and I had some interest in him. And through a discussion in our private lessons, he asked if I would be interested in learning how to do some of this work, as he was starting to get out of it a little bit more due to the health issues. And so I started working with him. My freshman and sophomore year in high school, we built a viola together. Mm-hmm. And I worked on my junior and senior year restoring and maintaining instruments in the school district, ones that they owned. I built a violin in my high school, which was very interesting, and kind of gone from there.
Yeah, it's not every young man who can take credit for something like that at such a tender age. That's great. Well, I understand that there's a game you like to play.
Sure.
That we're going to try to play right now. So tell us what we're going to be playing.
Well, what we're going to be playing is, I understand you are quite a musical connoisseur yourself.
To some extent.
One of the things we wanted to try is to kind of put to the test this idea of different instruments and different price ranges and old versus new. People will come to us quite often, and there are a lot of things going around where people say, oh yes, it's an old instrument. I must have an antique instrument because they assume it will sound a particular way. Similarly, people might say, I want a German cello or an Italian violin, for example, something from a geographical region, because they also have something predetermined that they expect this instrument will sound like. And one of the parts of the education of this job, I suppose, is helping people find these instruments and getting past some of the where it's made or what color it is or how old it is, and helping them find really the instrument that is right for them. So what I wanted to try, just for a point of fun, is to see if I've got a couple instruments put aside, three of them. I'd like to play them for you and see if you can discern which one might be the oldest one, which one is our rental violin, and which one is one of our mid-price range handmade instruments.
All right, interesting.
Might be illuminating.
Okay, I hope so. Okay, so away we go. So we'll step into the main showroom once again, and Stephanie Shumanova is floating about, and we're going to be chatting with her again before we are done. And again, hanging in this main showroom is a absolutely stunning array of all kinds of different instruments, violins and violas and cellos. I see a number of bows hanging up on the wall as well. Everything that you need in order to explore the beautiful world of string instruments. So I think Spencer is behind this wall, if I'm not mistaken.
You are correct.
Okay. So I'm supposed to listen to these three instruments and try to determine which one is the oldest and the rental and the youngest?
Let's just start with, I'll play you three instruments. I'm not going to do anything terribly ground-shaking. I'm not the best musician in the world, but I'm just going to play a couple octaves of G major scale on a couple different instruments, just back-to-back. And after the three, see if you have any impressions or even anything about the sound, whether or not you're picking out which instrument is which, or just any comments on the sound that you hear, and maybe we can talk through what you're hearing.
Sounds good.
So this will be number one.
Number one. Nice scale, Spencer.
Thank you. My fourth grade music teacher would be proud.
So this is number two?
Yes, this will be number two.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little warmer sound, a little more mellow. Beautiful also.
And I will switch over then to number three.
Number three. Also, that strikes me as kind of in between the two. Some of the mellow qualities of the second one, some of the brightness of the third.
Absolutely.
And I don't have the foggiest idea which one is the oldest and which one is the youngest. In fact, maybe that's part of the point of this demonstration. I would guess that they are all roughly of the same vintage. I mean, one of them does not sound like an antique compared to the others.
Sure. Well, let's take a look. So I'll bring out, I won't take them all out, but just for example, this is the first instrument we listened to. This is an instrument made in the early 20th century, German violin, handmade instrument, an antique. And was there anything about it specifically that you could have thought was antique by the sound?
Absolutely not. No, absolutely not. It had a beautiful brilliance to it and clarity. I guess in some ways that's maybe what surprises me. If we think of an instrument being decades old, we might not imagine it having that kind of clarity. It really does.
Absolutely. And you're right on. The whole point of this, I guess, is kind of to listen to a few different things of different ages. This is an antique instrument that we have part of our inventory. We purchased this instrument and restored it, and it's available for sale currently. The second instrument that you heard was one of our rental instruments, one of our standard rental violins you could walk in and rent today. And the third instrument was an instrument handmade in Europe by a contemporary maker. I think it's about 2 years old.
Hmm.
But the ultimate point being, and this is what I was alluding to a little bit before, is just based on how old it is or where it was made does not necessarily tell you what it will sound like, nor is something so striking that you can, even if you have played a lot of instruments, necessarily say, yes, that violin is absolutely German or is 100 years old or anything like that. So
we shouldn't go into this with too many presuppositions.
Absolutely. Very absolutely.
You know, when you look at this instrument, there is nothing old-looking about it. So clearly this violin, first of all, has been well taken care of, and to whatever extent there's work that's had to be done on it, that work has been very skillful.
Absolutely. This is one that we restored. This is a good example of what we will do on an instrument that is 100 years old and needs some love. We do everything from replacing the parts like the pegs, the bridge, the tailpiece, the chin rest, these accessories, new strings, of course, but then also going over the body, touching up places where there may be scratches or damage, polishing everything so it looks nice and unified, and it doesn't necessarily look like a brand new instrument with no signs of age, but it looks very complete and well taken care of.
It really does. While we're looking at the instrument, explain to our listeners and to me the point of this distinctive space that we always see on the face of violins and other string instruments.
Oh, sure. Well, the main reason is just the mechanics of playing the instrument. As you are drawing a bow across the strings, you need to have some room for that bow to get all the way to the lowest string and all the way up to the highest string. If this was just a square box, your bow would hit the side of that before it got all the way to the end.
So it allows a little more in the way of maneuvering for the bow.
Correct. And as the instrument has evolved, I mean, it's structural as well. In these corners, there are some little block supports. Maybe we saw in the instrument that was in progress in the other room before, too. But it's structural, it's functional, and it's aesthetic as well. Three things that most instruments are or should be.
How many different kinds of wood are we talking about here?
So in particular, instruments are coming with three main different types of wood. The black parts that you see on this instrument are all of a wood called ebony, which is an African wood, very hard, very dense, wears very nicely, has good acoustic properties. The top of the instrument is made out of spruce. Spruce can come from different parts of the world. A lot of the best spruce comes from Europe, sometimes from America or different regions as well. And then the rest of the parts, so your sides, your back, your neck, even the bridge, are made out of maple. And again, a lot of very good maple comes from the Balkan area, where classic violins originated. So we had kind of a leg up with some good wood selection there. Also other parts of Europe. And the wood that is selected, you know, words like spruce and maple, even though these are not uncommon in the Midwest, these Midwestern trees are not the best necessarily for this. We're looking usually for wood that has a very specific type of grain, has grown in a controlled way, so that there is evenness about it. So just don't go to your neighbor's house and cut down their maple tree and make a violin out of it. It won't be the same.
This is wood,
wood that's also usually aged and prepared a very specific way to have a good moisture content and be dried and ready to work so that it doesn't warp when you carve it up.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, how about that line that we see on the backside of the of this instrument? Do we always see that?
Sometimes. So this instrument has what's called a two-piece back. Mm. It's two pieces of maple that are glued down the center joint. A lot of times we see this in instruments, or they might have a one-piece back where it's from one large single piece of wood. Sometimes it's aesthetic. Sometimes it depends just on the material that's available. Can go both ways. Some people will again say a two-piece back sounds worse than a one-piece back or have things like that, but again, it's very much case by case.
Sure. And then one more question about the front of the violin. The these two areas right here that looks almost like long cursive S's.
Yes.
What is the function of that?
So these are your sound holes, or as we call them in the trade, F holes, because they kind of look like a cursive letter F. Mm. They are to essentially, it'd be the difference between talking with your mouth closed and talking with your mouth open. These allow the sound to escape from the inside of the instrument. Their design and their position is not accidental. This is something that has evolved through many, many years, hundreds of years of work and research. The subtle shape and position of them can be a signature between different makers. And when recreating a historical instrument, that's something that's taken into account.
Wonderful. Speaking of historical instruments, does your expertise extend beyond the standard kind of modern-day instruments, or are we talking about luthiers who would specialize in something like the viol da gamba and other older instruments, the predecessors of the instruments around
sure.
us?
Sure. Most of what we wind up doing here is modern violin family instruments, not necessarily gamba or viol family instruments. It completely depends. There is a lot of crossover that could be done, but a lot of it is also there aren't a lot of people that are playing the period instruments, so just as it's not always common to find a luthier, it's then even less common to find these instruments around. So,
right.
But they are certainly, there are a lot of analogs and a lot of things very similar, and the setups and the tools and the knowledge that we have carries over very well. You may have also even seen in the other room, we had the banjo and the mandolin hanging
all
on
right.
the wall there in progress. There's
yep.
even a lot of carryover with those. So.
Part of the family. So, for instance, are you repairing that banjo?
Yes, that banjo and that mandolin were in the process of, they were in a house fire.
Oh.
And so we're getting them set back up to go.
Wow. Very good. Spencer Hammond is the one of the luthiers here at Classic Violins, and we're going to be finishing out by moving into what is known as the trial room. And I'm assured that this is not a courtroom, that in fact the trial room is actually the space in which a prospective customer here at Classic Violins can actually hear various instruments in use and come to make a choice of what they would like to purchase and or rent. So explain, Stephanie, typically what happens in this room. How do such sessions typically unfold?
Yeah, so while a customer is renting from us, they're building rental equity, which they can later use to purchase an instrument from us. We carry instruments in the price range starting from $800 and going up to $30,000. So when the customer is ready to purchase an instrument, they would usually tell us what price range they would like to buy an instrument, and we'll prepare a number of instruments in their price range with matching bows. And we'll have one of our violinists reserved for them so that they can help them try instruments, narrow down their choice. And the customer then takes out up to four instruments on a weekly trial. Mm. So what happens in this room is the customer with Spencer or Dana, one of our violinists, will play instruments and then will eventually choose the instrument that they would like to purchase.
So that is quite a range that you just mm-hmm. quoted between, I think you said, 800 for the cheapest
right.
to maybe upwards of $30,000, and I'm sure there are violins that cost much more than that.
Correct.
What is the difference between those relatively inexpensive instruments and the ones that are at the top of that range in terms of how they have been built or what they are built from? I mean, what accounts for that difference?
That's an excellent question. The cheaper instruments are usually made by a team of makers. All the instruments that we sell here are handmade and hand-varnished. However, when the instrument is towards the lower price range, a number of makers were participating in order to build that instrument. So one maker would be building the top, another maker will be building the back or the scroll, and then they'll assemble the instrument together. The instruments in the higher price range, usually more than $2,000, are built by only one maker. So that maker would build the instrument and varnish the instrument, and those instruments will have his name inside.
And by one maker, do you mean one person?
One luthier, yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I suppose part of that is then you have one person with sort of a guiding oversight over every detail of that instrument versus one that's been sort of created piecemeal, in a sense that that instrument can't possibly be created with quite the same sense of care, I suppose.
Yes, that's correct, and then that will affect the sound of the instrument. The other factor that affects the sound and the price is the age of the wood. So the older the wood is, the more expensive the instrument will be, because the older woods will resonate better and mm-hmm. produce better sound.
Right. So when we have, for instance, a young musician coming in here thinking about, oh, that's a cute little cello, isn't it?
Yeah.
when a young musician is coming in and anxious to buy, let's say, their first or second violin, I suppose, or viola, or cello, mm-hmm. we shouldn't neglect the other instruments. What kinds of things are they typically looking for? What are sort of the factors that help somebody choose the right instrument for them?
Well, we would usually tell them to do a blind test, just like we did with you. Mm. So we'll ask them to tell us their price range, but we'll prepare instruments that are outside their price range as well. And if they choose the cheaper instrument, that's fine. This instrument sounds good to the player. He feels well with this instrument. It's comfortable. It fits his playing ability. So after they do the blind test, then we can help them choose an instrument within their new price range. And they should really pay attention to, when a person is renting from a violin shop, they should pay attention to the price range of instruments that are offered, the makers that are offered in that violin shop, because they will have more choices in a shop that deals primarily in string instruments.
Very good. In our last minute or so, just tell us briefly about a couple of the other things that Classic Violins offers to the community.
Well, we are actually going to offer a special for the Kenosha Unified School District for their new recruitment season here. We're going to offer 4 months for the price of three, and this special is going to run for the months of May through August.
Very good. And I know there are educational programs that occur. In fact, Spencer, I think you do some of that. Correct?
Yes, indeed. We've done lectures through different schools and for private groups. We had a larger tasting, actually, of what we had done for you, blind, for a group of local students. We do lectures on various aspects of the instrument making, materials involved, history of instruments and instrument makers. As I kind of alluded to before, there is a lot of education that comes along with this, so we're not just talking to ourselves, and that's something that we do offer, and we'd be happy to discuss with different needs of different groups or schools to help pass along some of the information that we know.
Very good. For people who want more information, what's your phone number and what's your web site address?
Well, they can find us at classicviolins.com, where they can rent their instrument 24/7. And for the phone number, it's 262-577-5488, and we'll be happy to help you.
Stephanie Shumanova, it's been great to meet you and great to visit your beautiful business. Thank you for welcoming us here.
Thank you very much, Greg, for coming.
And Spencer Hammond, great to meet you as well, and great to see you at work, and best wishes to you.
Likewise. Thank you, sir. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Gregory Berg. Thank you for listening to The Morning Show on WGTD.
And again, my thanks to WGTD's Troy McDonald and his two talented crew members for helping make our morning show visit to classic violins possible. Tomorrow on the morning show, the author of a brand new book called The Unknown, which tells the story in meticulous detail of the unknown soldier from the First World War.